So good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me in the back, Lance? I'm Ann Kenny. I'm proud to be the Carl A. Kroc University Librarian at this great institution. And I want to welcome all of you to the library's annual reunion lecture, which will be given by Dr. Doug Ancek. His talk ties in well with the current exhibit at Cornell Library, Animal Legends, From the Trojan Horse to Godzilla. What's not to like about an exhibit with that kind of title? But the exhibit in part addresses the power of our relationship with animals. Many of us experience that power through the context of companionship and affection, but some people believe that connection goes even deeper, encompassing not only physical but mental health. It's generally accepted that by petting a dog or a cat or some other fuzzy friend, one can relieve stress, lower your blood pressure, lower your heart rate, and just feel happier. There may be serious medical implications, too, in a much cited study from 1980 in the Journal of Public Health Reports. It showed that patients who had been hospitalized because of some form of heart disease were more likely to stay healthy if they went home where there was a pet. A year after hospital stays, 28% of patients who did not own a pet had died, compared to just 6% who did. Of course, the evidence is far from conclusive, and subsequent studies have not definitively borne out that correlation, but it's clear that the human-animal relationship runs deep. More proof exists for the softer side of science. Witness the last few decades where there's been a huge proliferation of therapy programs that involve pets visiting hospitals, assisted living facilities, and other places where people under stress can benefit from their calming influence. And libraries, too, are getting into the act. With early literacy programs springing up at public libraries across the country that pairs children with their dogs to come to the library to read. And this spring, Yale Law Library began allowing stressed out students to check out a therapy dog for a 30-minute session, citing the dog's positive effect on emotional well-being. I don't know what effect it had on their grades. But the program, which involved an 11-year-old Jack Russell Border Terrier mix called Monty, was so successful that it's been extended for the fall semester as well. And I'm pleased to let you all know that we've just recruited the originator of this program, Femi Cadmus, to direct the law library, and she arrives in August. Lord knows what she's bringing with her. All these connections suggest that society is still revising the conversation we have with ourselves about animals. And the language we use, the actual words we choose, is a big part of that conversation. You may have caught the story coming from the UK in which the editors of the Journal of Animal Ethics called on people to nix the word pet, arguing that the term is dismissive. Instead, they suggest people should call domestic animals like dogs and cats and hamsters and gerbils and canaries and, yes, lizards, companion animals. And in place of pet owners, they suggest human carers. Although this does sound a little bit far-fetched, the editors believe derogatory language about animals can affect the way they are treated. This new conversation, the idea of re-exploring the ground that we once thought we understood, is also hinted at in the title of Dr. Ancek's talk, Hybrids and Chimeras, Real and Imagined, Crossing Forbidden Boundaries in the Animal Kingdom. Dr. Ancek has made important contributions in the fields of equine immunology, genetics, and reproduction. He's a Cornellian, graduated with a BA in 1969, and was captain of the university polo team. And polo has remained important to him and his family. You have two daughters, Doug, who were on the polo team? After completing a degree in veterinary medicine from the University of Pennsylvania in 1973, he then went on to Cambridge, where he received his PhD. And since 1979, he's been on the scientific staff of Cornell's Baker's Institute for Animal Health. And in 1992, he was appointed the Dorothy Havemeyer McConville Professor of Equine Medicine at the Veterinary College. Before I turn the podium over to him, I want to thank those responsible for the Animals Legends exhibit, Laurent Ferry, Catherine Reagan, and Aisha Prather, and nearly two dozen other Cornell Library staff members who helped to put it together. And I want to invite you to join us after Doug's talk for a reception and exhibition viewing immediately following, which will be in the Kroc Library Hirschland Gallery. I'd also like to thank our donors, Stephen E. and Evelyn Edwards Millman. This is our second exhibition funded through the Millman family's generosity. And we're so grateful for their faith in us and their commitment to telling the stories the library's collections have to offer. This exhibition is composed almost solely from the library's own rare materials. The fact that we can rely on our own strengths to stage an exhibition as broad and rich and fascinating and as eclectic as this one is truly a credit to Cornell's amazingly supportive community of students, scholars, alumni, staff, and to the donors who make it all possible. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Anzek to the podium.
Thanks, Anne. Thank you very much. Thanks, Anne, for that very generous introduction. You can hear me in the back. Right. So what I need to know is, when's supper? 5:30, and that's okay. it's a real honor and a great pleasure to be giving the reunion library lecture. When I was a student here back in the 1960s, I used to spend a lot of time in the library. I was mostly trying to meet girls, and that was not very successful. And the second reason for going was to study, and that was also unsuccessful most of the time. I would fall asleep an awful lot of the time, especially in the presidential library, the beautiful A.D. White part over in Eurus. Anyway, I have warm memories of those days. So, okay. Why is this dog on the top slide here? Anybody recognize the dog? It's a hunting dog. Right. It's a dog with great Cornell connections. The dog is on a stamp. This is a duck stamp. These are stamps that are sold by the government and bought by hunters so they can shoot more ducks. We make more ducks and shoot them. Instead of making more chickens and eating them, this is how we keep the game going. And this is a dog that was owned by a man named John Olin, who was a very generous benefactor and graduate of this university. His name is King Buck. He was the most famous Labrador field retriever of the past century. The 1900 to 2000. And of all the duck stamps, there's one produced every year. There's only been one that's had any image of an animal except a duck on it. And that was John Olin's King Buck. Okay, so we're going to talk about hybrids and chimeras, the various kinds. I tried to have an interesting title that would get a lot of people here, and that's worked, but we'll see. We're going to try to do these things and this 20 minutes or half an hour or 2 hours, however long it takes, a little sense of place, hybrid versus chimera, what's the difference? We'll do some definitions. Then we'll talk about hybrids and chimeras and some iconic Cornell animals. In preparing for this talk, I tried to follow the rules that I learned from Professor Howard Evans, who's here in the audience today. I've enjoyed his lectures for many, many years, and I know that he just makes up stuff most of the time. So I've only followed that in half. Half the stuff I'll tell you is true, but I'm not sure which half is which. Okay, so where are we today? Anybody recognize this? Yeah, you all rec. This was a gimme, isn't it? Because if some of you were worried that this was going to be a scientific talk, I was told that I had to throw in some easy stuff for the English majors who were back. Okay, that sounds like there's a lot of them in the audience. That's great. Anyway, there we are down at the foot of beautiful Cayuga Lake. So here's some images of Cornell. And can you identify these buildings? How about this one? War. No, Howard, no fair. Anybody who lives here now, no fair. War Memorial. How about this one up here? Down here? How about this? It's still standing. Very well done. That's not fair either, I think, either. No, it's not. That's the McClintock Shed. This is over in the plantations, across from the new visitor center, which is a very beautiful building. Not as important as the building across the field from it. This is where Barbara McClintock and George Beadle did their classic plant breeding work with corn in the early 1920s, for which Barbara was awarded the Nobel Prize. And it's my introduction to a view of Cornell, and that view is that Cornell is a very distinguished university. It has an outstanding law school, terrific strengths in architecture, government, history, hotel management, a whole range of disciplines that are not found in very many universities. But biology is the overriding discipline at Cornell, and you know that because there are three entire colleges devoted to biology: the medical school, agriculture and life sciences, and veterinary medicine. And if you want to count Cutter Medical School, there's a fourth. So that's the lens through which I've seen Cornell. It's through this biological lens. And I hope that will inform some of the things I'll say today. So in this perspective, I come from the Baker Institute. That's where I've been working for 30 years. It's a tiny little pimple on the veterinary college, which is part of the greater Cornell. It's about 10% of the vet school faculty, and we conduct research there. It's a research institute, mostly on dogs, but quite a bit on horses, and something on other species as well. This is where we sit, farther above Cayuga's waters than the rest of you all. We're up on a place called Snyder or Hungerford Hill, and we're down here somewhere now, and Veterinary College is up here, and these are the Baker Institute grounds. It's a very beautiful place, and if you haven't visited, I hope you'll get a chance on one of your trips back to Cornell. That's enough for that introduction. Okay, so now hybrid versus chimera, what's the difference? Well, a hybrid is a result of mating of two different organisms, different species, and the result is a blend of the parent species. So, I got that one from Howard Evans. It's going to be hard to get serious again after that. I mean, do you really want to be? It's 5 o'clock somewhere. We should be having a drink at this time of day. So the most common animal hybrid is the mule, and that is really the it's my favorite animal, and it's what I spend most of my time thinking about and working on. And you can mate a horse with a horse, and you get an animal that is like a little horse comes out. If you mate a mare horse with a jack donkey, you get an animal that looks sort of like a horse and sort of like a donkey, but it's really a blend of the two. It has long ears like a donkey and a body like a horse, and that's called a mule. But the outcome of these crosses depends upon which way you do the cross. So if you take a male donkey, breed it with a female horse, you get an animal that's called a mule. But if you do the opposite cross with a stallion mated with a female donkey, that animal's called a hinny. And that's actually a very profound observation, that these two animals might be different because they have half their genes from their mother, half from their father. But they get them in opposite directions in this interspecies cross. And we could discuss this for a long time, but I'll spare you that, and we might come back to it at the end if we have a lot of time. But it's really very, very interesting observation and part of nature. Now, a chimera is different. A chimera is a mixture of two separate organisms with discrete parts of each organism. So who's this up here? Centaur, right, in Sagittarius, and that's You all know that from mythology. Even the English majors would know this. Oh, that's good. You can answer a few questions here. Right. Okay, so that's it for that. You now know the difference between a chimera and a hybrid. If you didn't know that before, you know it now, and we'll go over it a little bit more now. What's that? You're welcome to ask questions at any time, please. I enjoy interruptions. Right. So, okay, we're going to talk about hybrids a little bit now and a little bit more about the mule. The mule has made a number of really important contributions to scientific thought. It was the first genetically engineered animal, and there have been mules around for about 2,000 years at least. People have been breeding them, starting in the Middle East, and it's a real ideal animal for an agriculturalist to breed because the offspring is sterile. So if you breed a mule and sell it to someone who wants to use that mule, they can't go off and breed that mule again. It's like selling them hybrid corn these days that's sterile. You have to that mule breeder can sell another one the next year because that fellow who bought that mule can't breed it. And it blends the genes of two different species, and the outcome is better in many ways than either parental species. And that defines the term hybrid vigor, which we all know about, and it was defined in light of the observations made about mules. They're stronger than the donkey, and they're more resistant to disease and injuries than the horse is, and they live for about 40 years, whereas the horse lives maybe 30 and the donkey maybe 35. They live longer than each parent species and have fantastic capabilities for work. They also provided evidence against Aristotle's seed and soil hypothesis. And this was the idea of homunculus, that inside the sperm there was a little person, and that the female only provided sort of the seed bed where the seed would grow. But when you look at a mule, you know that it's not just like the seed that came from the donkey. It's a blend of both parent species. So that debunks that old idea about seed and soil. A lot of the ideas that I've learned about mules come from this gentleman, is Professor Roger Short, who was an A.D. White visiting professor for several years here. He's an Englishman now in Australia and a veterinary scientist and a really fantastic guy. So. And of course, mules made great contributions to work and warfare over many, many centuries. Harry Truman was a great fan of mules. They have a fantastic, fantastic history and probably not much of a future, but some of us still like them. Now, here are some pictures of some unusual mammalian hybrids. So we're still talking about hybrids now, like mules. Up here we have a what? A what? Up in the upper right. That's a zorse, yeah, or a zebroni or something. It's a horse family crossed with a zebra. In this case, it was a spotted horse, and so you get a very unusual color pattern where only the back half of this hybrid is striped like a zebra, and it's a really beautiful animal. That's one kind. These two down here are cat family hybrids, which are also very unusual. This one down here is a lion-tiger. And the lion-tiger cross is a bit like the mule. It's larger than both the lion and the tiger, and very unusual and hard to get. There's some old pictures of these on the internet. It's very hard to make them anymore because they're both endangered species. But it's really, really very, very interesting one. And this one is not Photoshop. That is a lion crossed with a leopard. Really very, very interesting phenotype there. And down here in the lower left is the Kama, which is a camel llama cross. And that was done by Lulu Skidmore, who's another friend of mine who works out in Dubai at the Center for Camel Reproduction. He works for Sheikh Mohammed, the ruler of Dubai, and he has a really big camel reproduction center. And this was a fantastic hybrid. It was produced by using semen sperm from llamas, New World llamas, and inseminating them into female camels like this one. Now, those species have been separated by 20 million years of evolution, and there haven't been any other hybrids made across that kind of a gap. So this is a very unique animal, the world's newest hybrid and a really fantastic one. To give you an example of how close horses and donkeys are, they've only been separated about 1 to 3 million years. So imagine being separated 20 million years and still being able to cross hybridize. It's really a fantastic little animal, the little comma. So hybrids are kind of neat. So how about these guys? Anybody know what these animals are? Catfish. Is a catfish a hybrid? This is an English major question. You can get extra points for this on the quiz. How about this? If this is a catfish, then this might be a... Oh, it's a dogfish. It's a dogfish. How about this? That's a horsefly. this is a seahorse. And this is, what's this one? Sea dragon, excellent. There's a beautiful display at the Scripps Aquarium in San Diego. If you want to see these guys, they're fantastic animals. It's interesting that we give these some names that are similar to some of the old mythological names that people would give to animals, and some of them really look mythological. It's just incredible. Now, you know, dogs have a great variation in phenotype. That's the way they look. And that means you can have some that are really big. This is the Great Dane. All you can see is its legs and a little chihuahua. But dogs of all breeds are members of the same species. That means they can interbreed, even though you wouldn't think that they could do that. So these days we're making designer dogs by breeding across breeds. So what do we have here? Well, what's this one? And this is a Labrador, and you get a what? Okay. And this one? Cocker Spaniel, and a poodle gets a? And this is a? It's a Bull Terrier, and this is a? It's a Shih Tzu, that's right. We'll go on to that now. Okay. That was a rude one. Okay, some of you guys got that one. It was too fast for some, but it's okay. Really, this is going to sound silly, but this is really, really important cutting-edge genetics. One of the areas I'm really lucky I'm blessed to work in three distinct areas of biology: immunology, genetics, and reproduction. And on the genetics side, I get to go to conferences and hear about advances in genetics in all species. And I was just at one a couple of weeks ago down at the Cold Spring Harbor Lab in Long Island, and I learned a bit about what's being known about the genome of Neanderthals, the genetic makeup of Neanderthals. That the genome sequencers, like led by Svante Paabo, who works in Germany, has taken tiny little fragments of Neanderthal bones, isolated DNA, and determined the genome of the Neanderthal, and used that information to determine, using genetic methods, how long ago Neanderthals and humans were a single species, where the common ancestor was. They've also been able to compare human genomes and ask the question of whether there's any evidence of Neanderthal genes in the human genome. And they found that there is. And the amount is quite significant, upwards of 5 to 7%. Neanderthals used to live in the Neander Valley. You could have called it the Cayuga Lake Basin, but that's where they lived. And out of Africa came the modern humans, and the word the geneticists use is admixed. They admixed with the Neanderthals. And they all used to live in caves in those days, like this. Came out of Africa, had mixed with the Neanderthals. This was Neanderthal territory. There was another group of Neanderthal-like creatures called the Denisovans. They lived up here in Siberia, and they have their genome has been sequenced. They were distinct from the Neanderthals, and you can find in people of European and Asian ancestry evidence of about 7%, 5 to 10% of your genome is common with that of Neanderthals. We've been separated from them for 30,000 years or so. And in some of the tribes in Papua New Guinea and those islands out there, there's evidence for a different kind of genome, which is probably the Denisovan genome. And they might have 7% Neanderthal and 5% Denisovan. So they might be 12 or 15% different from us. And in fact, the Africans who came out from Africa have no evidence of any Neanderthal genes in them, no evidence of admixture. So they're the real pure humans, Homo sapiens. Really, really interesting, and it gives you a lot to think about. Right. This is Ed Marinaro. We could test for this now. This project is sort of my wife was right project. You know, I am a Neanderthal. Okay, so that's enough of the hybrids. Now we're going to do chimeras, which is just as interesting, believe me. So there were a lot of chimeras in mythology, and you're all familiar with these. Now the history majors and any of those other old guys can really pitch in here. What was this? What's this one called? This one is just called the Greek chimera or chimera. And it's part lion and part snake and part goat, and it's quite fanciful. Here's some others. What are we looking at up here? Centaur, we had him before. Minotaur, great. Excellent. Beautiful. Perfect. Boy, there must be a lot of history English major types in there. You guys got those, did great on those things. A lot of really interesting creatures that are chimeras. And remember, these are individuals that have discrete parts derived from different species. Sometimes they're animal-animal, and sometimes they're animal-human. So where are we headed in terms of chimera biology in the future? Well, within species, within an individual species, naturally occurring chimeras are very rare. But they're sometimes found. And one of the classic examples is something called a free marten. And free martens occur when usually a dairy cow, has twins, carrying two embryos, two fetuses. And if they're of opposite sex, you can get a condition of sterility. But what happens in these dairy cattle that are carrying two twins is that they have a common placenta, and the blood from one fetus can go into the other, and blood from this fetus can go into this one. So you can end up as blood chimeras. They'll have these two. They're non-identical twins. They're not identical. So that means they have different genes, half from their mother and half from their father. And they would have different blood types. But if you look at this, if these were born, then you could look at this one. It would have blood type A, but it might have 5% of the blood type of its co-twin and vice versa. And studying these animals led to our elucidation of the theory of immunological tolerance, which is one of the major breakthroughs in biology over the last half century. So this is an example of a naturally occurring chimera, but it's within a species. Chimeras between species are extremely, extremely rare, and they may not exist at all. Now, there is a very interesting kind of chimerism that happens in humans, and it's called fetal maternal chimerism, and this work has been pioneered by Dr. Lee Nelson, who is a rheumatologist. She studies rheumatic diseases, autoimmune diseases at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I've met her at several conferences over the years, in fact, and heard her speak just a couple of weeks ago. She has been using very, very sensitive DNA-based techniques to ask whether a pregnant woman would have evidence of cells from the fetus that she carried in her blood after the baby's born, and to ask whether the baby would have evidence of cells that have trafficked from the mother to the fetus while she was pregnant. And she finds that this is actually quite common. So that, and this could apply to all of us, male or female, if we were born of a mother, as most of us were. I could very well have a small fraction of my blood cells that derive from my mother's blood type and not mine, foreign to me. And if you are a woman who was born of a mother and has had children yourself, you can be a triple or quadruple chimera and have cells from your mother that you got when you were a fetus and cells from your fetuses that crawled into you, crawled across the placenta into you while you were pregnant. So all of us out here, you know, I mean, you can use the royal we. We're two or three or four different individuals. And the consequences of this type of chimerism, it's called microchimerism because it's a very tiny fraction of your body is actually somebody else's. The consequences are not really known, but there are some very striking and very interesting associations between autoimmune diseases and chimerism of this type. And I'm not going to go into the details of that, but it's probably not just incidental. It's probably an important biological phenomenon. Okay.
There's a question.
Question?
I hope you really don't mind being interrupted.
No, I don't.
If the blood cells are in the body after the baby's born, do they reproduce in the body? I mean, how do you maintain that in the blood supply over time?
Probably, it's probably due to these special kinds of cells called stem cells. That some kind of stem cells get across. But it's really, this is really new, a new field of biology, and it's not very much is known about it at all. But it's probably some kind of stem cell that can keep on replicating.
Okay. Thank
you. But they can be long lasting. You can detect these for 20, 30, 40 years after you've had a child, for example.
Okay.
So now I said that cross species chimeras are very rare. These are a couple of examples of sheep-goat chimeras that were made by another scientific friend and colleague of mine, a veterinarian originally from Denmark, Dr. Steen Willidsen, who is just a genius at manipulating small embryos. And he would take an embryo from a goat and an embryo from a sheep and split them both in half and mix them together with one part sheep and one part goat. And then he'd transfer them either to a goat or a sheep mother, and they would grow up and be born, and you'd get an animal that looks mostly like a goat, but it has a whole patch of wool over here and over here. So this is a true chimera. It has distinct parts of its body are derived from a different species. And these two species are actually quite far apart. You know, we sort of would think that sheep and goats are similar because they're small and they're sort of furry, and they give milk and whatever, but in fact, you can't breed sheep and goats together. They're much further apart than horses and donkeys are. So it's a big genetic gap. And yet, those cells can grow up in that environment and function very, very well. And the rumor is, although I don't know this was ever proved to be true, that the males of these can be chimeric in their testes, and so you can breed them to a sheep to get a sheep and breed them to a goat and get a goat. Which is very efficient if you only want to keep one male around on the property. So that's possible. This was done about 20 years ago, in fact. But the area where chimerism, another area where chimerism might be headed in the future, is in producing spare parts for us all. You know, it's harder. If anybody here had a transplant? That's unusual. Usually when I ask a group this size, there's at least one person that's had one. How about a hip replacement? Yeah, I've had one of those myself, so that's good. But that's not living part. But if you do need a transplant, there are not as many donors as there are recipients who need transplants. And that's because we have these horrible helmet laws for bicycles and motorcycles and stuff. And seatbelt laws and things that prevent good, fresh roadkill, which makes fantastic organ donation material. Sorry, this is a vet speaking. It's not an MD lecture. It's a vet. But it's true. The supply of organs went down with traffic safety going up. So we're trying to engineer animals to provide organs for people, and the animal of choice is the pig because it's physiologically most like humans, and there's been quite a lot of progress made in genetically modifying pigs so that their tissues are less antigenic. They will evoke less of a response when transferred to a human, and we may well be having livers and kidneys and other organs from genetically modified pigs within our lifetime. It's happening pretty fast. So we may well become chimeras of sort. Okay. Now we're on to the last part, so you guys have been good. Not too many people have left yet. It's great. Iconic Cornell animals. So when you go over to the exhibit today, you're going to learn about this Cornell chimera called the Unimal, which was developed by Professor Howard Babcock to teach students about agriculture. And I'm going to try to do this now. If I can see. Right, got it. Let's go over here and go down here and is it going to work?
It's mute.
Why is it mute? Press the mute button. Let me stop this. Wait a minute. If I go down here, I'm going to try it right from here. It looks like it's got sound. Well, I do have the speakers in. Nope, it's not. No sound. Battery charger? No, it's all up. Remember, I'm old. The young people can help me with this. Take this and see if this will work now. No, I need help. It's Joe Lockwood, the guy who's on the radio here, who talks about gardening. It's a fantastic little...
How far up, guys? All right. That one?
There?
I'm trying to move over there.
There, okay, here we go. There. It's up. It's already, it's up.
But it's grayed out.
Well, anyway, you should go and look at this. It's really quite interesting. And it's made in the 1950s or so, or 60s, and there's Howard Babcock with the little Unimal, and it's a feat. So he clicks it, and out comes a bottle of milk. He clicks it again, and out comes a dozen eggs, and it's really critical. If you watch this, here he goes. Oop, there it is. There's a little something or other. You click it again, and oop. There's the bottle of milk. That's right. So, you know, when you see this, I have to go back now to my show. When you see this, you're probably already thinking this already. The Shmoo, LCAP Shmoo. Some of you people remember the Shmoo. So what does the Shmoo do? What can you get out of the Shmoo? Well, it gives milk and eggs and butter, and you don't have to churn the butter. If you fry it, it tastes like chicken. If you broil it, it tastes like steak. And, you know, it's just like the perfect animal. And it's really one of these guys. And, you know, it's not that, you know, we're getting close. And I think that was a really interesting part of the exhibit. Okay, so I started out talking about King Buck, John Olin's dog. And John was the real benefactor who started the Baker Institute going. And there was a very charismatic initial leader, James Andrew Baker, who was a vet from Cornell, who wanted to found a veterinary research institute. And he did so in 1950, and it became extraordinarily successful. The vaccines for canine distemper were developed at the institute in the early 1950s. And the effect of that vaccine on the dog population was very similar to the polio vaccine on human population, which was developed at about the same time. It really changed the way dogs live. And the reason our dogs are dying of cancer now is because they're living past the age of two. They used to die of distemper and canine herpes virus and infectious hepatitis and a whole bunch of other common infectious diseases, which were virtually all controlled by measures developed at the Baker Institute. Most recently, the canine parvovirus, which is one of these new emergent viruses, was discovered by Baker Institute scientists, and the vaccine was made within a couple of years. That was patented, and that was the most successful patent at Cornell from the period of 1980 until 2000. It was one of the top two or three in the whole history of the university. The Institute has become so successful at controlling infectious diseases of dogs that we started to work on other kinds of problems, like especially genetics, and we've had great success in genetic studies as well. This dog is one of the iconic Cornell dogs. She's Tasha. Sadly, she's dead now, but she was the DNA donor for the canine genome sequence. When people study dog genetics now, they use Tasha's sequence. And Tasha was owned by Greg Ackland, one of our scientists. And this is a little biotech company which was spun off by Greg and his colleagues from the work that they do to identify genes that cause inherited eye diseases of dogs. And that's very important in itself, and I could talk about that for a long time, but there was a real fantastic spin-off to human medicine and human disease that I'd like to mention. And this brings up another iconic Cornell dog, and this is Lancelot, who's a Briard. And Briards have a rare inherited eye disease, which is very similar to a disease in humans called Leber's congenital amaurosis. And that's a disease in which children who have this are born blind. They can't see at all. And the dogs are the same way. They're born blind. And what Gus Aguirre and Greg Ackland and their colleagues did was to, they identified the gene that was defective in this condition, and it's a similar gene in humans and in dogs, and they made a copy of the normal gene, and they injected it into the retina, the back of the retina, because that's where the problem is, in the retinal cells, of one eye of Lancelot, and Lancelot learned to see with that one eye. And he was taken to Washington, was on the steps of the Capitol, increased the budget to the National Eye Institute by 10% just on the basis of this one experiment. This was done in the year 2000, and there are already children who were born blind, who have been given the same therapy, who are no longer legally blind. It's the most successful application of gene therapy that's been described yet. And it's the fastest transition time from an experiment to human trials of anything I know for this kind of treatment. So we also work on horses at the Baker Institute, and this is the barn where I keep my research herd. We've been pushing the envelope of assisted reproduction for a long time at the Baker Institute. And these are some examples of mules, sterile hybrids, in which we transferred either horse or donkey embryos and allowed those sterile mules to go to term. This was done back in the mid-1980s, and this is a horse mare that carried a donkey embryo to term. This is a completely cross-species embryo transfer. This would be similar to putting a chimpanzee embryo into a woman or vice versa, a human embryo into a chimpanzee. And it really tells us a lot about the strength and the power of the mechanisms that are in play during pregnancy to prevent the mother from rejecting her fetus. Not only will she not reject a fetus of her own species, she won't reject a fetus of a closely related species. And that's a very interesting topic, which I, again, will not tire you with. The Baker Institute has two iconic animals with respect to genome sequencing. This is Twilight, who is one of the horses in my research herd, and she was the donor of the DNA for the Horse Genome Project. So in our one little institute, we have the DNA donors for the Dog Genome Project and the Horse Genome Project, and that's a real feather in the cap for Cornell. Now, I'm going to close with my favorite project at Cornell, and it's one I wish I was working on, but I'm not. This is the Fox Domestication Project. You might have seen this cover of National Pornographic a couple of months ago, which featured the fox on its cover. This is Dr. Anna Kukakova, who came to Cornell from Russia, and she came to study dog eye disease, but her secret desire was to work on these foxes that had been tamed through a captive breeding program in Novosibirsk in Russia. Do you all know about that program? A lot of you do, some of you do, some of you don't. So about 50 years ago, some really wacko Russian geneticists got together with the fur breeders and said, gee whiz, wouldn't it be nice if you had tame foxes, and then we could make fur coats we could grow them like we grow foxes, like we grow cattle and sheep. They don't have to be wild, aggressive foxes. So they started this program where they would take now, I hope I'm going to get some sound here, but I'm afraid I'm not. No, where's my sound man? Anything there? You don't know what's going on, do you? I'll try to pull this out and see what happens. Okay. Can you hear any of that? Okay, so there's a peasant up there on the right. They have a lot of those in Russia and Siberia. And the peasant would go to this 3x3 cage, and there'd be about 50 foxes there, and they'd put their hand in and see if the fox is going to bite. This is one of the aggressive ones. They don't even wear gloves. So that's what you'd expect from a typical wild fox. Some of the foxes were not so aggressive, and they would take the ones that were less aggressive and breed them together, and the ones that were more aggressive and breed them together, and they did this for less than 50 years, only about 7 or 8 generations. And what they got at the end was foxes that are like behave like this. It's like a cross between a dog and a cat. It's the most amazing thing. So I want you to, while you're watching this, I want you to think, how many species of domestic animal do you know about? Can you name? The answer is less than 15. Probably less than 10, because cats don't count. They're not really domesticated. Biologists have thought that it would take hundreds of years to domesticate a species, and it was a very, very difficult process. But with a fox, it took less than 50 years. This is a blink of an eye. And it's just an incredibly magical process that we don't really understand, but it's one of the most interesting projects in biology. Now, the good news for the animal rights folks is that this project failed to produce tame foxes that could be used by the fur trade, because in addition to changes in their behavior, they also change the way they look. And you can see that they have spotted coat colors, and their ears flop over more, their tail grows up. This is a little wild, you know, one of these tame foxes with a little child. They've developed coat colors which remind you of a spotted cocker spaniel or a black and white dairy cow or spotted horse. And that's when a light bulb goes off that every species of domestic animal has at least one breed within it, except for the camel, where there's a spotted coat color, like a pinto, you know, spotted coat color. And those coat colors are never found in nature. You find spots like a cheetah has, and you find stripes, but you never find the patches that you find in the domestic species. So that those genes that are, the gene that controls tame behavior is probably very close on the chromosomes to the genes that control these coat colors. So that's a really, really interesting project. And this is a study that Dr. Kukukova is working on. It's funded now by the National Institute of Mental Health, and we're trying to find cognate genes, that is the genes in the fox which correspond to genes in the human, which might influence one's behavior, and it could be used in studies of autism, and they could test prisoners, and you know, they could do all kinds of things, that some good, some bad, but we'll see how that goes. Interesting one. But anyway, those are fantastic videos. So this is one of my favorite quotes from Albert Einstein. Imagination is more important than knowledge. That's because I have so little of it. but it's a funny thing. I found this back in 2000 in a horseman's magazine called The Blood Horse, which is like the most anti-intellectual publication on earth, published by the thoroughbred breeders. And to have them quoting Albert Einstein is just amazing. They were trying to get people to buy, you know, semen from very, very, very high-priced stallions, and if they had any knowledge, they would never do it, so they had to have a lot of imagination and expect that their mare would produce a winner. Okay, so we're going to end here with Twilight and Ezra Cornell himself, and you remember that when Ezra was waving goodbye to A.D. White, New York Harbor, sending him off to find find the first faculty, he said, did you get that? I don't know. Let's do that again. Come on, Ezra.
And don't forget the horse doctor.
Okay. Right.
And don't forget the horse doctor.
Right. Here, thank you, Ezra. Okay, so that's it. Done. Now, you're welcome to ask questions or go to dinner. It's almost dinner time. Or to don't forget going over to the exhibit, to tour the exhibit. Any questions? For hybrid animals, is it all achieved? Pregnancies achieved with artificial insemination most of the time, but not always.
Some of it is natural.
Some of it is natural. Yep, but most is artificial insemination. Jackalope and Santa Fe. I've seen those out west. Yeah, they're that's a chimera, all right. Those are good ones. I should have had one of those in this. I'll remember that for next time. Thank you. Question?
Are wolves and dogs the same species?
Wolves and dogs are not the same species, but they're very close and they can interbreed. Yes, the offspring are fertile. In fact, there's another paper that just came out saying that they've looked at the percentage of wolf and dog and coyote in the eastern wolves and the western wolves, and there's it's a bit like the Neanderthal story. There's quite a bit of admixture.
What's the significance of this science with regard to human cloning?
Human cloning. That's a really good question. What's significance with respect to human cloning? Well, human cloning is not something we talk about very much. And probably we wouldn't do human cloning. But if anybody here has ever had identical twins, any of the women have identical twins? You have, there's one, Lynn, Joya has, you know, identical twins are clones. It's not something we haven't had before, naturally. And it may just be a matter of time, but I'm not sure we'd want another of most of us. It is a major ethical question, and it leads us to the topic of epigenetics, which we haven't talked about today at all, and that identical twins really aren't not identical, so you wouldn't expect them to be as bad as the original. They might be better.
Wasn't there another characteristic of the friendly foxes in the Russian study that they had a curly tail or a raised
Yes, that's right. Yep, the tails did change. In the Russian foxes, the tail curve did change as well. That's right.
You had a slide in which you indicated that there was like a 5 to 7% overlap in the genome of the Neanderthals in certain areas with humans.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering, there must be different ways of assessing that percentage, because I've seen claims that the human species shares something like 95 or 98% of the genome with a chimpanzee.
Yes.
So there must be multiple ways of assessing this percentage going on here, right?
Yes, that's the question about what does it mean to be genetically similar to one species or another, or to one individual or another? And that's a really very perceptive question. It's hard to give a clear answer. It's because there are so many different ways of assessing similarity in the genes. And when we say that we're 95% similar to chimpanzees or 98% similar, you might ask, well, does that mean that we have 22,000 structural genes and 21,000 of them are present in chimpanzees? That's one way of saying they're 98% identical. Another way is to say whether the exact string of nucleotides, the DNA code, is identical between humans and a Neanderthal ancestor. And that's a different way of assessing that. So it's a bit like the federal deficit and debt and all those kinds of gibberish that the economists give us. You can get very confused doing it. But I'd say that from my perspective, I'm happy to believe that we do have 5% Neanderthal gene, Neanderthal DNA. There's 5% Neanderthal DNA in humans, in some humans, and more in others. Okay, time for the reception, or that one last question? Horse and donkey make a mule, right?
Horse and the donkey make a mule. Does that translate to humans? Even though humanity is just one race, hybrids in different ethnic cultures, for example, do they produce like a stronger human? Could we associate that or no?
Well, I mean, we've always thought that close inbreeding is bad. So in that sense, it does translate. And outbreeding is often good because we all carry a certain number of genetic mutations. And in individuals who are closely related to us, they probably carry those same kind of mutations. And for many of those, if you have two copies of that mutation, you'll show a genetic disease phenotype. You'll express that disease. And if you marry someone from outside of your genetic group, it's less likely that they will carry the same set of mutations. So you're more likely to be genetically robust. So in that sense, it does hold.
I just thought it was interesting, if you take a historical context, let's say World War II and the Nazi kind of regime that wanted to perpetuate a super race.
Pure race.
Breeding within, where right. It would actually be the opposite. External breeding might actually produce desirable genetic.
Right. No, it's just the opposite. Just the opposite is what it's that's the fuel for evolution and for progression in any species. If you become very too much homogeneous, you can select for a good phenotype, but you won't be able to make any more genetic progress. You won't be able to adapt to changing environmental conditions in the future, because those conditions work on the variation in the DNA in the population. Okay, I think that's it. Thanks very much again.